then lifted the broomstick in both hands and brought it down across her knee. It broke with a loud crack, and she threw the pieces aside. "I am a direwolf, and done with wooden teeth." That night, she lay in her narrow bed upon the scratchy straw, listening to the voices of the living and the dead whisper and argue as she waited for the moon to rise. They were the only voices she trusted anymore. She could hear the sound of her own breath, and the wolves as well, a great pack of them now. "They are closer than the one I heard in the Godswood," she thought. "They are calling to me." Finally, she slipped from under the blanket, wriggled into a tunic, and padded barefoot down the stairs. Bruce Bolton was a cautious man, and the entrance to King's Pyre was guarded day and night, so she had to slip out of a narrow cellar window. The yard was still, the great castle lost in haunted dreams. Above, the wind keen through the wailing tower. At the forge, she found the fires extinguished and the doors closed and barred. She crept in a window, as she had once before. Gendry shared a mattress with two other apprentice smiths. She crouched in the loft for a long time before her eyes adjusted enough for her to be sure that he was the one on the end. Then she put a hand over his mouth and pinched him. His eyes opened. He could not have been very deeply asleep. "Please," she whispered. She took a hand off his mouth and pointed. For a moment she did not think he understood, but then he slid out from under the blankets. Naked, he padded across the room, shrugged into a loose, rough-spun tunic, and climbed down from the loft after her. The other sleepers did not stir. "What do you want now?" Gendry said in a low, angry voice. "A sword. Black Thumb keeps all the blades locked up. I told you that 100 times. Is this for Lord Leech?" "For me. Break the lock with your hammer. They'll break my hand," he grumbled, "or worse." "Not if you run off with me. Run, and they'll catch you and kill you." "They'll do you worse. Lord Bolton is giving Harrenhal to the bloody mummers. He told me so." Gendry pushed black hair out of his eyes. "So?" She looked right at him, fearless. "So when Varga hoats the lord, he's going to cut off the feet of all the servants to keep them from running away, the smiths too." "That's only a story," he said scornfully.
"No, it's true. I heard Lord Vargo say so," she lied. "He's going to cut one foot off everyone, the left one. Go to the kitchens and wake Hot Pie, and he'll do what you say. We'll need bread or oatcakes or something. You get the swords, and I'll do the horses. We'll meet near the postern in the east wall, behind the Tower of Ghosts. No one ever comes there."
"I know that gate. It's guarded, same as the rest."
"So? You won't forget the swords?"
"I never said I'd come."
"No, but if you do, you won't forget the swords." He frowned. "No," he said at last, "I guess I won't." Arya re-entered King's Pyre the same way she had left it, and stole up the winding steps, listening for footfalls. In her cell, she stripped to the skin, and dressed herself carefully, in 2 layers of small clothes, warm stockings, and her cleanest tunic. It was Lord Bolton's livery. On the breast was sewn his sigil, the flayed man of the Dreadfort. She tied her shoes, threw a wool cloak over her skinny shoulders, and knotted it under her throat. Quiet as a shadow, she moved back down the stairs. Outside the Lord Solar, she paused to listen at the door, easing it open slowly when she heard only silence. The sheepskin map was on the table, beside the remains of Lord Bolton's supper. She rolled it up tight and thrust it through her belt. He'd left his dagger on the table as well, so she took that too, just in case Gendry lost his courage. A horse neighed softly as she slipped into the darkened stables. The grooms were all asleep. She prodded one with her toe
until he sat up groggily and said, "Eh? Was—"
"Lord Bolton requires 3 horses saddled and bridled."
The boy got to his feet, pushing straw from his hair.
"What? At this hour? Horses, you say?"
He blinked at the sigil on his tunic.
"What's he want horses for, in the dark?"
"Lord Bolton is not in the habit of being questioned by servants." She crossed her arms. The stable boy was still looking at the flayed man. He knew what it meant.
3, you say?
1, 2, 3. Hunting horses, fast and surefoot. Arya helped him with the bridles and saddles, so he would not need to wake any of the others. She hoped they would not hurt him afterwards, but she knew they probably would. Leading the horses across the castle was the worst part. She stayed in the shadow of the curtain wall whenever she could, so the sentries walking their rounds on the ramparts above would have needed to look almost straight down to see her. And if they do, what of it? I'm my lord's own cupbearer. It was a chill, dank autumn night. Clouds were blowing in from the west, hiding the stars, and the wailing tower screamed mournfully at every gust of wind. It smells like rain. Arya did not know whether that would be good or bad for their escape. No one saw her, and she saw no one. Only a grey and white cat creeping along atop the godswood wall. It stopped and spit at her, waking memories of the Red Keep and her father and Sirio Forel. "I could catch you if I wanted," she called to it softly. "But I have to go, cat." The cat hissed and ran off. The Tower of Ghosts was the most ruinous of Harrenhal's 5 immense towers. It stood dark and desolate behind the remains of a collapsed sept, where only rats had come to prey for near 300 years. It was there she waited to see if Gendry and Hot Pie would come. It seemed as though she waited a long time. The horses nibbled at the weeds that grew up between the broken stones, while the clouds swallowed the last of the stars. Arya took out the dagger and sharpened it to keep her hands busy. Long, smooth strokes, the way Sirio had taught her. The sound calmed her. She heard them coming long before she saw them. Hot Pie was breathing heavily, and once he stumbled in the dark, barked his shin, and cursed loud enough to wake half of Harrenhal. Gendry was quieter, but the swords he was carrying rang together as he moved. "Here I am," she stood. "Be quiet, or they'll hear you." The boys picked their way toward her over tumbled stones. Gendry was wearing oiled chainmail under his cloak, she saw, and he had his blacksmith's hammer slung across his back. Hot Pie's red, round face peered out from under a hood. He had a sack of bread dangling from his right hand and a big wheel of cheese under his left arm. "There's a guard on that postern," said Gendry quietly. "I told you there would be." "You stay here with the horses," said Arya. "I'll get rid of him. Come quick when I call." Gendry nodded. Hot Pie said, "Hoot like an owl when you want us to come." "I'm not an owl," said Arya. "I'm a wolf. I'll howl." Alone, she slid through the shadow of the Tower of Ghosts. She walked fast to keep ahead of her fear. And it felt as though Sirio Forel walked beside her, and Yorin, and Jaqen H'ghar, and Jon Snow. She had not taken the sword Gendry had brought her, not yet. For this, the dagger would be better. It was good and sharp. This postern was the least of Harrenhal's gates, a narrow door of stout oak, studded with iron nails, set in an angle of the wall beneath a defensive tower. Only one man was set to guard it, but she knew there would be sentries up in that tower as well, and others nearby walking the walls. Whatever happened, she must be quiet as a shadow. He must not call out. A few scattered raindrops had begun to fall. She felt one land on her brow and run slowly down her nose.
She made no effort to hide, but approached the guard openly, as if Lord Bolton himself had sent her. He watched her come, curious as to what might bring a page here at this black hour. When she got closer, she saw that he was a Northman, very tall and thin, huddled in a ragged fur cloak. That was bad. She might have been able to trick a Frey, or one of the brave companions, but the Dreadfort men had served Bruce Bolton their whole life, and they knew him better than she did. "If I tell him I am Arya Stark, and command him to stand aside." No, she dare not. He was a Northman, but not a Winterfell man. He belonged to Bruce Bolton. When she reached him, she pushed back her cloak so he would see the flayed man on her breast. "Lord Bolton sent me."
"At this hour? Why for?"
She could see the gleam of steel under the fur, and she did not know if she was strong enough to drive the point of the dagger through the chainmail. His throat. It must be his throat. But he's too tall. I'll never reach it. For a moment, she did not know what to say. For a moment, she was a little girl again and scared, and the rain on her face felt like tears. "He told me to give all his guards a silver piece for their good service." The word seemed to come out of nowhere.
"Silver, you say?"
He did not believe her, but he wanted to. Silver was silver, after all.
"Give it over, then."
Her fingers dug down beneath her tunic and came out clutching the coin Jaqen had given her. In the dark, the iron could pass for tarnished silver. She held it out and let it slip through her fingers. Cursing her softly, the man went to a knee to grope for the coin in the dirt, and there was his neck right in front of her. Arya slid the dagger out and drew it across his throat, as smooth as summer silk. His blood covered her hands in a hot gush, and he tried to shout, but there was blood in his mouth as well.
"Velar Magullis," she whispered as he died.
When he stopped moving, she picked up the coin. Outside the walls of Harrenhal, a wolf howled long and loud. She lifted the bar, set it aside, and pulled open the heavy oak door. By the time Hot Pie and Gendry came up with the horses, the rain was falling hard.
"You killed him!"
Hot Pie gasped. "What did you think I would do?" Her fingers were sticky with blood, and the smell was making her mare skittish. "It's no matter," she thought, swinging up into the saddle. "The rain will wash them clean again."
Daenerys. The flies circled Khal Drogo slowly, their wings buzzing, a low thrum at the edge of hearing that filled Dany with dread. The sun was high and pitiless. Heat shimmered in waves of the stony outcrops of low hills. A thin finger of sweat trickled slowly down between Danny's swollen breasts. The only sounds were the steady clop of their horses' hooves, the rhythmic tingle of the bells in Drogo's hair, and the distant voices behind them. Danny watched the flies. They were as large as bees, gross, purplish, glistening. The Dothraki called them blood flies. They lived in marshes and stagnant pools, sucked blood from man and horse alike, and laid their eggs in the dead and dying. Drogo hated them. Whenever one came near him, his hand would shoot out quick as a striking snake to close around it. She had never seen him miss. He would hold the fly inside his huge fist long enough to hear its frantic buzzing. Then his fingers would tighten, and when he opened his hand again, the fly would be only a red smear on his palm. Now one crept across the rump of his stallion, and the horse gave an angry flick of its tail to brush it away. The others flitted about Drogo, closer and closer. The Khal did not react. His eyes were fixed on distant brown hills, the reins loose in his hands.
Beneath his painted vest, a plaster of fig leaves and caked blue mud covered the wound on his breast. The herb woman had made it for him. Miri Mazdur's poultice had itched and burned, and he had torn it off 6 days ago, cursing her for a meji. The mud plaster was more soothing, and the herb woman made him poppy wine as well. He'd been drinking it heavily these past 3 days. When it was not poppy wine, it was fermented mare's milk, or pepper beer. Yet he scarcely touched his food, and he thrashed and groaned in the night. Danny could see how drawn his face had become. Rago was restless in her belly, kicking like a stallion. Yet even that did not stir Drogo's interest as it had. Every morning her eyes found fresh lines of pain on his face when he woke from his troubled sleep. And now, this silence, it was making her afraid. Since they had mounted up at dawn, he had not said a word. When she spoke, she got no answer but a grunt. And not even that much since midday. One of the blood flies landed on the bare skin of the Carl's shoulder. Another, circling, touched down on his neck and crept up towards his mouth. Carl Drogo swayed in the saddle, bells ringing, as his stallion kept onward at a steady walking pace. Danny pressed her heels into her silver and rode closer. "My lord," she said softly, "Drogo, my sun and stars." He did not seem to hear. The blood fly crawled up under his drooping moustache and settled on his cheek in the crease beside his nose. Danny gasped, "Drogo!" Clumsily she reached over and touched his arm. Carl Drogo reeled in the saddle, tilted slowly, and fell heavily from his horse. The flies scattered for a heartbeat and then circled back to settle on him where he lay. "No!" Danny said, reining up. Heedless of her belly for once, she scrambled off her silver and ran to him. The grass beneath him was brown and dry. Drogo cried out in pain as Danny knelt beside him. His breath rattled harshly in his throat, and he looked at her without recognition.
"My horse!" he gasped.
Danny brushed the flies off his chest, smashing one, as he would have. His skin burned beneath her fingers. The car's blood riders had been following just behind them. She heard Hago shout as they galloped up. Kaholo vaulted from his horse.
"Blood of my blood," he said as they dropped to his knees.
The other two kept to their mounts.
"No,"
Carl Drogo groaned, struggling in Danny's arms.
"Must ride, ride, no."
"He fell from his horse," Hago said, staring down. His broad face was impassive, but his voice was leaden. "You must not say that," Danny told him. "We have ridden far enough today. We will camp here."
"Here?"
Hago looked around him. The land was brown and sere, inhospitable.
"This is no camping ground."
"It is not for a woman to bid us halt," said Kotho. "Not even a Khaleesi."
"We camp here," Danny repeated. "Hago, tell them Carl Drogo commanded the halt. If any ask why, say to them that my time is near and I could not continue. Kaholo, bring up the slaves. They must put up the Carl's tent at once. Kotho,
you do not command me, Khaleesi,"
Kotho said. "Find Miramar's door," she told him. The guard's wife would be walking among the other lamb men in the long column of slaves. "Bring her to me, with her chest." Kotho glared down at her, his eyes hard as flint.
"The meji?"
he spat.
"This I will not do."
"You will," Danny said, "or when Drogo wakes, he will hear why you defied me." Furious, Kotho wheeled his stallion around and galloped off in anger. But Danny knew he would return with Miramar's door, however little he might like it. The slaves erected Carl Drogo's tent beneath a jagged outcrop of black rock whose shadow gave some relief from the heat of the afternoon sun.
Even so, it was stifling under the sand silk as Iri and Doria helped Danny walk Drogo inside. Thick patterned carpets had been laid down over the ground and pillows scattered in the corners. Iroa, the timid girl Danny had rescued outside the mud walls of the Lem men, set up a brazier. They stretched Drogo out on a woven mat.
"No,"
he murmured in the common tongue.
"No, no."
It was all he said, all he seemed capable of saying. Doria unhooked his medallion belt and stripped off his vest and leggings, while Xiqui knelt by his feet to undo the laces of his riding sandals. Iri wanted to leave the tent flaps open to let in the breeze, but Danny forbade it. She would not have any see Drogo this way, in delirium and weakness. When her cars came up, she posted them outside at guard. "Admit no one without my leave," she told Drogo. "No one." Iroa stared fearfully at Drogo where he lay.
"He dies,"
she whispered. Danny slapped her. "The Carl cannot die. He is the father of the stallion who mounts the world. His hair has never been cut. He still wears the bells his father gave him." "Khaleesi," Xiqui said. "He fell from his horse." Trembling, her eyes full of sudden tears, Danny turned away from them. "He fell from his horse." It was so. She had seen it. And the blood riders, and no doubt her handmaids, and the men of her cars as well. And how many more? They could not keep it secret. And Danny knew what that meant. A Carl who could not ride, could not rule. And Drogo had fallen from his horse. "We must bathe him," she said stubbornly. She must not allow herself to despair. "Iri, have the tub brought at once. Doria, Iroa, find water, cool water. He's so hot." He was a fire in human skin. The slaves set up the heavy copper tub in the corner of the tent. When Doria brought the first jar of water, Danny wet a length of silk to lay across Drogo's brow over the burning skin. His eyes looked at her, but he did not see. When his lips opened, no words escaped them, only a moan. "Where is Miramar's door?" she demanded, her patience rubbed raw with fear.
"Kotho will find her," Iri said.
Her handmaidens filled the tub with tepid water that stank of sulphur, sweetened it with jars of bitter oil and handfuls of crushed mint leaves. While the bath was being prepared, Danny knelt awkwardly beside her lord husband, her belly great with their child within. She undid his braid with anxious fingers, as she had on the night he'd taken her for the first time, beneath the stars. His bells she laid aside carefully, one by one. He would want them again when he was well, she told herself. A breath of air entered the tent as Ego poked his head through the silk. "Khaleesi," said, "the Andal has come and begs leave to enter." The Andal was what the Dothraki called Ser Jorah. "Yes," she said, rising clumsily, "send him in." She trusted the knight. He would know what to do if anyone did. Ser Jorah Mormont ducked through the door flap and waited a moment for his eyes to adjust to the dimness. In the fierce heat of the south, he wore loose trousers of mottled sand silk and open-toed riding sandals that laced up to his knees. His scabbard hung from a twisted horsehair belt. Under a bleach-white vest, he was bare-chested, skin reddened by the sun. "Talk goes from mouth to ear all over the Kalasar," he said. "It is said Khal Drogo fell from his horse." "Help him," Danny pleaded. "For the love you say you bear me, help him now." The knight knelt beside her. He looked at Drogo, long and hard, and then at Danny.
"Send your maids away."
Wordlessly, her throat tight with fear, Danny made a gesture. Iri heard at the other girls from the tent. When they were alone, Ser Jorah drew his dagger. Deftly, with a delicacy surprising in such a big man, he began to scrape away the black leaves and dried blue mud from Drogo's chest. The plaster had caked.
hard as the mud walls of the Lemmen, and like those walls, it cracked easily. Sir Jorah broke the dry mud with his knife, pried the chunks from the flesh, peeling off the leaves one by one. A foul, sweet smell rose from the wound, so thick it almost choked her. The leaves were crusted with blood and pus, Drogo's breast black and glistening with corruption.
"No," Danny whispered as tears ran down her cheeks. "No, please. Gods, hear me. No." Khal Drogo thrashed, fighting some unseen enemy. Black blood ran slowly and thick from his open wound.
"Your Khal is as good as dead, Princess."
"No, he can't die. He mustn't. It was only a cut."
Danny took his large, calloused hand in her own small ones and held it tight between them.
"I will not let him die."
Sir Jorah gave a bitter laugh.
"Khaleesi, or Queen, that command is beyond your power. Save your tears, child. Weep for him tomorrow or a year from now. We do not have time for grief. We must go, and quickly, before he dies."
Danny was lost.
"Go? Where should we go?"
"Eshai, I would say. It lies far to the south, at the end of the known world, yet men say it is a great port. We will find a ship to take us back to Pentos. It will be a hard journey, make no mistake. Do you trust your cars? Will they come with us?"
"Khal Drogo commanded them to keep me safe," Danny replied uncertainly. "But if he dies..." She touched the swell of her belly.
"I don't understand. Why should we flee? I am Khaleesi. I carry Drogo's heir. He would be Khal after Drogo..."
Sir Jorah frowned. "Princess, hear me. The Dothraki will not follow a suckling babe. Drogo's strength was what they bowed to, and only that. When he is gone, Jaco and Pono and the other Khos will fight for his place, and this Khalasar will devour itself. The winner will want no more rivals. The boy will be taken from your breast the moment he is born. They will give him to the dogs."
Danny hugged herself.
"But why?" she cried plaintively. "Why should they kill a little baby?
He's Drogo's son, and the crones say he will be the stallion who mounts the world. It was prophesied. Better to kill the child than to risk his fury when he grows to manhood."
The child kicked inside her, as if he had heard. Danny remembered the story Viserys had told her of what the usurper's dogs had done to Rhaegar's children. His son had been a babe as well, yet they had ripped him from his mother's breast and dashed his head against a wall. That was the way of men. "They must not hurt my son," she cried. "I will order my cars to keep him safe, and Drogo's blood riders will—" Sir Jorah held her by the shoulders.
"A blood rider dies with his Khal. You know that, child. They will take you to Vaes Dothrak, to the crones. That is the last duty they owe him in life. When that is done, they will join Drogo in the Nightlands."
Danny did not want to go back to Vaes Dothrak and live the rest of her life among those terrible old women. Yet she knew that the knight spoke the truth. Drogo had been more than her sun and stars. He had been the shield that kept her safe. "I will not leave him," she said stubbornly, miserably. She took his hand again. "I will not." A stirring at the tent flap made Danny turn her head. Miramar's Dur entered, bowing low. Days on the march, trailing behind the Khalasar, had left her limping and haggard, with blistered and bleeding feet and hollows under her eyes. Behind her came Kotho and Hago, carrying the god's wife's chest between them. When the blood riders caught sight of Drogo's wound, the chest slipped from Hago's fingers and crashed to the floor of the tent, and Kotho swore an oath so foul it seared the air. Mira Mars Dur studied Drogo, her face still and dead.
"The wound has festered."
"This is your work, Meji," Kotho said.
Hago laid his fist across Miri's cheek
with a meaty smack that drove her to the ground. Then he kicked her where she lay. "Stop it!" Danny screamed. Kotho pulled Hago away, saying, "Kicks are too merciful for a magi. Take her outside. We will stake her to the earth to be the mount of every passing man. And when they are done with her, the dogs will use her as well. Weasels will tear out her entrails, and carrion crows feast upon her eyes. The flies off the river shall lay their eggs in her womb and drink pus from the ruins of her breasts." He dug iron-hard fingers into the soft, wobbly flesh under the god's wife's arm and hauled her to her feet. "No," Danny said, "I will not have her harmed." Kotho's lips skinned back from his crooked brown teeth in a terrible mockery of a smile. "No? You say me no? Better you should pray that we do not stake you outside beside your magi. You did this as much as the other." Sir Jorah stepped between them, loosening his long sword in its scabbard.
"Rein in your tongue, Blood Rider. The princess is still your Khaleesi."
"Only while the blood of my blood still lives," Kotho told the knight. "When he dies, she is nothing."
Danny felt a tightness inside her. "Before I was Khaleesi, I was the blood of the dragon. Sir Jorah, summon my cars."
"No," said Kotho. "We will go. For now, Khaleesi."
Hago followed him from the tent, scowling.
"That one means you no good, princess," Mormont said. "The Dothraki say a man and his blood riders share one life, and Kotho sees it ending. A dead man is beyond fear."
"No one has died," Danny said. "Sir Jorah, I may have need of your blade. Best go don your armor." She was more frightened than she dared admit, even to herself. The knight bowed.
"As you say,"
he strode from the tent. Danny turned back to Mirah Mars Dua. The woman's eyes were wary.
"So you have saved me once more."
"And now you must save him," Danny said. "Please."
"You do not ask a slave,"
Miri replied sharply.
"You tell her."
She went to Drogo, burning on his mat, and gazed long at his wound.
"Ask or tell, it makes no matter. He is beyond a healer's skills."
The cow's eyes were closed. She opened one with her fingers.
"He has been dulling the hurt with milk of the puppy."
"Yes," Danny admitted.
"I made him a poultice of fire pod and sting-me-not and bound it in a lambskin."
"It burned," he said. "He tore it off. The herb women made him a new one, wet and soothing."
"It burned, yes. There is great healing magic in fire. Even your hairless men know that."
"Make him another poultice," Danny begged. "This time I will make certain he wears it."
"The time for that is past, my lady,"
Miri said.
"All I can do now is ease the dark road before him, so that he might ride painless to the Nightlands. He will be gone by morning."
Her words were a knife through Danny's breast. What had she ever done to make the gods so cruel? She had finally found a safe place, had finally tasted love and hope. She was finally going home. And now, to lose it all? "No," she pleaded, "save him, and I will free you, I swear it. You must know a way, some magic, some..." Mirah Mars Dua sat back on her heels and studied Daenerys through eyes as black as night.
"There is a spell."
Her voice was quiet, scarcely more than a whisper.
"But it is hard, lady, and dark. Some would say that death is cleaner. I learned the way in a shy and paid dear for the lesson. My teacher was a blood marsh from the Shadowlands."
Danny went cold all over. "Then you truly are a magi?"
"Am I?"
Mirah Mars Dua smiled.
"Only a magi can save your rider now, Sibyl Lady."
"Is there no other way?"
"No other."
Khal Drogo gave a shuddering gasp. "Do it," Danny blurted. She must not be afraid.
She was the blood of the dragon. Save him.
There is a price,
the god's wife warned her. You'll have gold, horses, whatever you like.
It is not a matter of gold or horses. This is blood magic, lady. Only death may pay for life.
Death? Danny wrapped her arms around herself protectively, rocking back and forth on her heels. My death? She told herself she would die for him, if she must. She was the blood of the dragon. She would not be afraid. Her brother Rhaegar had died for the woman he loved.
No,
Miramar's door promised.
Not your death, Khaleesi.
Danny trembled with relief. Do it. The Meiji nodded solemnly.
As you speak, so it shall be done. Call your servants.
Khal Drogo writhed feebly as Rakaro and Quaro lowered him into the bath.
No,
he muttered.
No, must ride.
Once in the water, all the strength seemed to leak out of him.
Bring his horse,
Miramar's door commanded, and so it was done. Jogo led the great red stallion into the tent. When the animal caught the scent of death, he screamed and reared, rolling his eyes. It took three men to subdue him. What do you mean to do? Danny asked her.
We need the blood,
Mira answered.
That is the way.
Jogo edged back, his hand on his arik. He was a youth of 16 years, whip-thin, fearless, quick to laugh, with a faint shadow of his first moustache on his upper lip. He fell to his knees before her. Khaleesi, he pleaded, you must not do this thing. Let me kill this Meiji. Kill her, and you kill your Carl, Danny said. This is blood magic, he said. It is forbidden. I am Khaleesi, and I say it is not forbidden. In Vaes Dothrak, Khal Drogo slew a stallion, and I ate his heart, to give our son strength and courage. This is the same. The same. The stallion kicked and reared as Rakaro, Quaro, and Ego pulled him close to the tub, where the Carl floated like one already dead, pus and blood seeping from his wound to stain the bathwaters. Miramar's door chanted words in a tongue that Danny did not know, and a knife appeared in her hand. Danny never saw where it came from. It looked old, hammered red bronze, leaf-shaped, its blade covered with ancient glyphs. The Meiji drew it across the stallion's throat, under the noble head, and the horse screamed and shuddered as the blood poured out of him in a red rush. He would have collapsed, but the men of her cars held him up.
Strength of the mount go into the rider,
Mira sang, as horse blood swirled into the waters of Drogo's bath.
Strength of the beast go into the man.
Jago looked terrified as he struggled with the stallion's weight, afraid to touch the dead flesh, yet afraid to let go as well. Only a horse, Danny thought. If she could buy Drogo's life with the death of a horse, she would pay 1,000 times over. When they let the stallion fall, the bath was a dark red, and nothing showed of Drogo but his face. Miramar's door had no use for the carcass. Burn it, Danny told them. It was what they did, she knew. When a man died, his mount was killed and placed beneath him on the funeral pyre to carry him to the Nightlands. The men of her cars dragged the carcass from the tent. The blood had gone everywhere. Even the sand-silk walls were spotted with red, and the rugs underfoot were black and wet. Braziers were lit. Miramar's door tossed a red powder onto the coals. It gave the smoke a spicy scent, a pleasant enough smell. Yet Eroa fled, sobbing, and Danny was filled with fear. But she had gone too far to turn back now. She sent her handmaids away.
Go with them, Silver Lady,
Miramar's door told her. I will stay, Danny said.
The man took me under the stars and gave life to the child inside me. I will not leave him.
You must. Once I begin to sing, no one must enter this tent. My song will wake powers old and dark. The dead will dance here this night. No living man must look on them.
Danny bowed her head, helpless. No one will enter. She bent over the tub, over Drogo in his bath of blood, and kissed him lightly on the brow. Bring him back to me, she whispered to Miramar's door before she fled. Outside, the sun was low on the horizon, the sky a bruised red. The Khalasar had made camp. Tents and sleeping mats were scattered as far as the eye could see. A hot wind blew. Jogo and Ego were digging a fire pit to burn the dead stallion. A crowd had gathered to stare at Danny with hard black eyes, their faces like masks of beaten copper. She saw Sir Jorah Mormont, wearing mail and leather now, sweat beading on his broad, balding forehead. He pushed his way through the Dothraki to Danny's side. When he saw the scarlet footprints her boots had left on the ground, the colour seemed to drain from his face.
"What have you done, you little fool?"
he asked hoarsely. "I had to save him."
"We could have fled," he said. "I would have seen you safe to a Shai princess. There was no need."
"Am I truly your princess?" she asked him.
"You know you are. God save us both."
"Then help me now," Sir Jorah grimaced.
"Would that I knew how."
Miramar's door's voice rose to a high, ululating wail that sent a shiver down Danny's back. Some of the Dothraki began to mutter and back away. The tent was aglow with the light of braziers within. Through the blood-spattered sand silk, she glimpsed shadows moving. Miramar's door was dancing, and not alone. Danny saw naked fear on the faces of the Dothraki.
"This must not be," Kotho thundered.
She had not seen the Blood Rider return. Hago and Koholo were with him. They had brought the hairless men, the eunuchs who healed with knife and needle and fire. "This will be," Danny replied.
"May she," Hago growled.
"And old Koholo. Koholo, who had bound his life to Drogo's on the day of his birth. Koholo, who had always been kind to her." Koholo spat full in her face.
"You will die, Meiji," Kotho promised, "but the other must die first."
He drew his arak and made for the tent.
"No," she shouted, "you mustn't."
She caught him by the shoulder, but Kotho shoved her aside. Danny fell to her knees, crossing her arms over her belly to protect the child within. "Stop him," she commanded her Kaas. "Kill him." Rakharo and Quaro stood beside the tent flap. Quaro took a step forward, reaching for the handle of his whip. But Kotho spun graceful as a dancer, the curved arak rising. It caught Quaro low under the arm, the bright, sharp steel biting up through leather and skin, through muscle and rib bone. Blood fountained as the young rider reeled backward, gasping. Kotho wrenched the blade free.
"Horse Lord," Sir Jorah Mormont called, "try me."
His long sword slid from its scabbard. Kotho whirled, cursing. The arak moved so fast that Quarrow's blood flew from it in a fine spray like rain in a hot wind. The long sword caught it, a foot from Sir Jorah's face, and held it quivering for an instant, as Kotho howled in fury. The knight was clad in chainmail, with gauntlets and greaves of lobstered steel, and a heavy gorget around his throat. But he had not thought to don his helm. Kotho danced backward, arak whirling around his head in a shining blur, flickering out like lightning, as the knight came on in a rush. Sir Jorah parried as best he could, but the slashes came so fast
that it seemed to Danny that Kotho had four arracks and as many arms. She heard the crunch of a sword on mail, saw sparks fly as the long curved blade glanced off a gauntlet. Suddenly, it was Mormont stumbling backward, and Kotho leaping to the attack. The left side of the knight's face ran red with blood, and a cut to the hip opened a gash in his mail and left him limping. Kotho screamed taunts at him, calling him a craven, a milkman, a eunuch in an iron suit. "You die now," he promised, Arrak shivering through the red twilight. Inside Danny's womb, her son kicked wildly. The curved blade slipped past the straight one and bit deep into the knight's hip, where the mail gaped open. Mormont grunted, stumbled. Danny felt a sharp pain in her belly, a wetness on her thighs. Kotho shrieked triumph, but his arrack had found bone, and for half a heartbeat it caught. It was enough. Ser Jorah brought his longsword down with all the strength left him, through flesh and muscle and bone, and Kotho's forearm dangled loose, flopping on a thin cord of skin and sinew. The knight's next cut was at the Dothraki's ear, so savage that Kotho's face seemed almost to explode. The Dothraki were shouting, Miramar's door wailing inside the tent like nothing human, Quarrow pleading for water as he died. Danny cried out for help, but no one heard. Rakaro was fighting Hago, Arrak dancing with Arrak, until Jogo's whip cracked loud as thunder, the lash coiling around Hago's throat. A yank, and the Blood Rider stumbled backward, losing his feet and his sword. Rakaro sprang forward, howling, swinging his Arrak down with both hands through the top of Hago's head. The point caught between his eyes, red and quivering. Someone threw a stone, and when Danny looked, her shoulder was torn and bloody. "No," she wept. "No, please stop it. It's too high. The price is too high." More stones came flying. She tried to crawl towards the tent, but Kahalo caught her. Fingers in her hair, he pulled her head back, and she felt the cold touch of his knife at her throat. "My baby!" she screamed, and perhaps the guards heard. For as quick as that, Kahalo was dead. Aegor's arrow took him under the arm to pierce his lungs and heart. When at last Daenerys found the strength to raise her head, she saw the crowd dispersing, the Dothraki stealing silently back to their tents and sleeping mats. Some were saddling horses and riding off. The sun had set. Fires burned throughout the Khalasar, great orange blazes that crackled with fury and spit embers at the sky. She tried to rise. An agony seized her and squeezed her like a giant's fist. The breath went out of her. It was all she could do to gasp. The sound of Miramar's door's voice was like a funeral dirge. Inside the tent, the shadows whirled. An arm went onto her waist, and then Ser Jorah was lifting her off her feet. His face was sticky with blood, and Danny saw that half his ear was gone. She convulsed in his arms as the pain took her again, and she heard the knight shouting for her handmaids to help him. "Are they all so afraid?" She knew the answer. Another pain grasped her, and Danny bit back a scream. It felt as if her son had a knife in each hand, as if he were hacking at her to cut his way out. "Daria, curse you!" Ser Jorah roared. "Come here! Fetch the birthing women!" "They will not come. They say she is accursed." "They'll come, or I'll have their heads." Daria wept. "They are gone, my lord." "The Meiji," someone else said. "Was that Aegor? Take her to the Meiji." "No," Danny wanted to say. "No, not that, you mustn't." But when she opened her mouth, a long wail of pain escaped, and the sweat broke over her skin. What was wrong with them? Couldn't they see?
Inside the tent, the shapes were dancing, circling the brazier and the bloody bath, dark against the sand silk. And some did not look human. She glimpsed the shadow of a great wolf, and another like a man wreathed in flames. "The lamb woman knows the secrets of the birthing bed," Ira said. "She said so. I heard her." "Yes," Doria agreed. "I heard her too."
"No,"
she shouted. Or perhaps she only thought it, for no whisper of sound escaped her lips. She was being carried. Her eyes opened to gaze up at a flat, dead sky, black and bleak and starless.
"Please, no."
The sound of Miramar's door's voice grew louder until it filled the world.
"The shapes," she screamed. "The dancers."
Ser Jorah carried her inside the tent.
John. He dreamt he was back in Winterfell, limping past the stone kings on their thrones, their grey granite eyes turned to follow him as he passed, and their grey granite fingers tightened on the hilts of the rusted swords upon their laps. "You are no Stark," he could hear them mutter in heavy granite voices. "There is no place for you here. Go away." He walked deeper into the darkness. "Father," he called. "Bran, Rickon." No one answered. A chill wind was blowing on his neck. "Uncle," he called. "Uncle Benjen. Father. Please, father, help me." Up above he heard drums. "They are feasting in the great hall, but I am not welcome there. I am no Stark, and this is not my place." His crutch slipped, and he fell to his knees. The crypts were growing darker. "A light has gone out somewhere."
"Ygritte," he whispered. "Forgive me, please."
But it was only a direwolf, grey and ghastly, spotted with blood, his golden eyes shining sadly through the dark. The cell was dark, the bed hard beneath him. His own bed, he remembered, his own bed in his steward's cell beneath the old bear's chambers. By rights it should have brought him sweeter dreams. Even beneath the furs he was cold. Ghost had shared his cell before the ranging, warming it against the chill of night, and in the wild Ygritte had slept beside him. Both gone now. He had burned Ygritte himself, as he knew she would have wanted. And Ghost, where are you? Was he dead as well? Was that what his dream had meant? The bloody wolf in the crypts? But the wolf in the dream had been grey, not white, grey, like Bran's wolf. Had the Thens hunted him down and killed him after Queen's Crown? If so, Bran was lost to him for good and all. John was trying to make sense of that when the horn blew. The horn of winter, he thought, still confused from sleep. But Mance never found Joriman's horn, so that couldn't be. A second blast followed, as long and deep as the first. John had to get up and go to the wall, he knew, but it was so hard. He shoved aside his furs and sat. The pain in his leg seemed duller, nothing he could not stand. He had slept in his breeches and tunic and small clothes for the added warmth, so he had only to pull on his boots and don leather and mail and cloak. The horn blew again, two long blasts, so he slung Longclaw over one shoulder, found his crutch, and hobbled down the stairs. It was the black of night outside, bitter cold and overcast. His brothers were spilling out of towers and keeps, buckling their sword belts and walking toward the wall. John looked for Pip and Gren, but could not find them. Perhaps one of them was the sentry blowing the horn. "It is Mance,"
he thought. He has come at last. That was good. We will fight a battle, and then we'll rest. Alive or dead, we'll rest. Where the stair had been, only an immense tangle of charred wood and broken ice remained below the wall. The winch raised them up now, but the cage was only big enough for 10 men at a time, and it was already on its way up by the time John arrived. He would need to wait for its return. Others waited with him. Satin, Mully, Spareboot, Keggs, Big Blonde Harith with his buck teeth. Everyone called him Horse. He had been a stable hand in Molestown, one of the few moles who'd stayed at Castle Black. The rest had run back to their fields and hovels, or their beds in the underground brothel. Horse wanted to take the Black, though, the great buck-tooth fool. Zay remained as well, the whore who proved so handy with a crossbow. And Noy had kept 3 orphan boys whose father had died on the steps. They were young, 9 and 8 and 5, but no one else seemed to want them. As they waited for the cage to come back, Clydes brought them cups of hot mulled wine, while 3 Finger Hub passed out chunks of black bread. John took a heel from him and gnawed on it. "Is it Mance Rayder?" Satin asked anxiously. "We can hope so." There were worse things than wildlings in the dark. John remembered the words the wildling king had spoken on the fist of the first men as they stood amidst that pink snow. When the dead walk, walls and stakes and swords mean nothing. You cannot fight the dead, Jon Snow. No man knows that half so well as me. Just thinking of it made the wind seem a little colder. Finally, the cage came clanking back down, swaying at the end of the long chain, and they crowded in silently and shut the door. Mully yanked the bell rope 3 times. A moment later, they began to rise, by fits and starts at first, then more smoothly. No one spoke. At the top, the cage swung sideways, and they clambered out 1 by 1. Horse gave John a hand down onto the ice. The cold hit him in the teeth like a fist. A line of fires burned along the top of the wall, contained in iron baskets on poles taller than a man. The cold knife of the wind stirred and swirled the flames, so the lurid orange light was always shifting. Bundles of quarrels, arrows, spears, and scorpion bolts stood ready on every hand. Rocks were piled 10 feet high. Big wooden barrels of pitch and lamp oil lined up beside them. Bowen Marsh had left Castle Black well supplied in everything save men. The wind was whipping at the black cloaks of the scarecrow sentinels who stood along the ramparts, spears in hand. "I hope it wasn't one of them who blew the horn," John said to Donald Noy, when he limped up beside him.
"Did you hear that?"
Noy asked. There was the wind and horses and something else.
"A mammoth," John said. "That was a mammoth."
The armourer's breath was frosting as it blew from his broad, flat nose. North of the wall was a sea of darkness that seemed to stretch forever. John could make out the faint red glimmer of distant fires moving through the wood. It was Mance, certain as sunrise. The others did not light torches.
"How do we fight them if we can't see them?" Horse asked.
Donald Noy turned toward the 2 great trebuchets that Bowen Marsh had restored to working order.
"Give me light," he roared.
Barrels of pitch were loaded hastily into the slings and set afire with a torch. The wind fanned the flames to a brisk red fury.
"Now!"
Noy bellowed. The counterweights plunged downward. The throwing arms rose to thud against the padded crossbars. The burning pitch went tumbling through the darkness, casting an eerie flickering light upon the ground below. John caught a glimpse of mammoths moving ponderously through the half-light, and just as quickly lost them again.
12, maybe more.
The barrel struck the earth and burst. They heard a deep bass trumpeting
and a giant roared something in the old tongue, his voice an ancient thunder that sent shivers up John's spine.